This is Your Afternoon with Howard Feldman. I am he, and I have a very, very real privilege this afternoon. Johnny Clegg is a South African musician. He's an anthropologist and a human rights activist. He has recorded and performed with his bands, Jaluka and Savuka. He is an iconic figure, and he has blessed the world with his music. Personally, for me, as an 80s teenager, Clegg was a symbol of hope. He proved that the narrative of our apartheid elders could be challenged. He proved even then that there were multiple rich and colorful strands in the fabric of the South African tapestry, and that we needed not fear that which we were told to fear. Johnny Clegg's music is the soundtrack of my youth, and he joins me in studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
Johnny, you're an icon to so many. Would the 20-year-old you be surprised at what was to follow?
Not really. I was really somebody engaged very much in my little world and in my tunnel, which mm-hmm. was to really, in certain respects, discover aspects of traditional Zulu migrant labor culture, which enabled me to identify and create an African identity for myself through language, through dance, through music. And obviously, when you talk about an ethnic identity or a cultural identity, you're talking about sentiments and values. You're talking about the way in which social bodies mm-hmm. and individuals interact. And it was a very, very intense journey for me. I never did it for any political reasons initially.
I see that you spent a lot of time denying that that politics is your thing. But in fact, I think you said in one of your articles, politics found you.
Yes, politics found me. Mm. I was moved by music. I discovered Zulu street guitar music when I was 14. And that's exactly 50 years ago. And I was playing guitar. My mom was a jazz and a cabaret singer. I grew up, my stepfather was a crime reporter, so I had a very interesting upbringing. When I discovered Zulu street guitar music, I understood and realized that this was a unique genre of guitar music, tuned differently. It was a Western instrument that had been reconfigured to play traditional Zulu music. And the picking style, the entire way. In fact, they with gay abandon, they just went in and just changed the strings around, changed the tuning, changed the way you played it. There were no chords. It was just notes played against each other. So I flashed on that. I thought, this is like the blues in America. The thing that hit me was that this guitar style exists only here. This is the only place in the world right now where this exists, and I want to learn to play it. And that was my door. It was through music. And as I learned it, and as I learned the traditional songs and some of the new compositions, but at that time in the late 60s, it was a lot of the songs that were transposed, war songs, historic songs, marriage songs, coming-of-age songs, songs of migrant workers having to leave home and travel. It was a compendium of lived experiences which had been transposed onto the guitar and onto the concertina as well. So it gave me this amazing window through music at another life, other lives, other ideas about what living in this country is about. So then my teacher, Charlie Mzila, took me to his traditional Zulu dance place, and I learned isiphaqa dancing. And then I went to the hostels, and that's where everything for me changed, because along the eastern side of Johannesburg, you have Jeppe, Denver, George Koch, and at that time, Wema Hostel. Wema Hostel was the biggest hostel.
Right.
And it's now the licensing department at the bottom of Rissing Street. So, Wema closed down in 1976. But that hostel is the incubator of my development.
How were you received there?
They, with generosity, with openness. They were amazing. These traditional migrants, most of them uneducated. When I met Sipho 2 years later, he couldn't read or write his own language. He never had any formal education. But they were rich in their own civilization. They were rich in their own culture. They were rich in their own idioms and proverbs and ideas about how all traditional societies have a very conservative idea about human beings and human culture. You know, that's why we have the Ten Commandments. We have all of these, you know, because we are open to all sorts of ideas and bad behavior. So the Zulus have got an incredible compendium of funny expressions and ideas about this, which, you know, you inherit if you're in the culture. So these were all put into music. They were in dance songs. They were in war songs. They were in, you know, and this is a, you know, all traditional cultures which are not literate, which don't have a written tradition.
Mm-hmm.
They have an oral tradition.
Right.
And the oral tradition, it's passed down. And how do you pass down key things over the centuries?
Right.
It's by a good melody.
Absolutely.
That's memorable. You know, so
yeah.
I was
That's
getting...
That's very evocative.
Yeah.
But what's so interesting to me is, you know, we were schooled in this whole notion, and it was reinforced in terms of the apartheid literature that we were forced to cover, was the tribalism and the different groups and how nobody would ever be able to get on.
Yes.
And yet the amazing thing, and what I find fascinating about your music, is that you embraced Zulu culture, but that united an entire country. Here was a little white Jewish boy who couldn't connect with Zulu and didn't have a need to. But in fact, what it did was that it connected me with all sorts of other South Africans. And it showed me that, hold on a minute, what we're being taught is really a load of baloney.
I think that when I look back at that time, I think that most South Africans at the end of the 60s and the beginning of the 70s had a sneaking suspicion that all of this stuff was junk. But the power structure was such that one lived in a certain amount of fear. You know, most people did.
Well, and certainly from a Jewish perspective, our grandparents had come out of – they'd fled in fear.
Yeah.
So our parents were told to keep their heads
Correct.
Below the parapet, and we were schooled in the same way. Our parents' biggest fear
was that
we would make ourselves known and land up in trouble.
And the amazing thing for me is that from the 70s to the 80s, in that period, you know, we had the June uprisings in 76. And every decade, if you go back, you know, from 1910 even, every decade you can see that generation of Africans, there was some massive protest by that generation. Mm. And then they got tired, and then the next generation came. And the 76 generation was the marking off of something very interesting. It was the youth not just rejecting apartheid. It actually was the youth rejecting their parents. It was a very, very strong – and rejecting their parents – acceptance and not acceptance,
acquiescence.
Accepting the there was a lot of arguments and fighting. And I remember when I met hostel dwellers in Soweto from Dube and Jabulani and from Marafi hostels, and they didn't join the strikes, and the young students came to meet the elders in the hostels to say, we want all the migrants also to go on strike.
Mm.
And they looked at them and they said, but you are children. Bring your fathers here.
Wow.
We want to talk.
Wow.
And they said, our fathers would never ask for this. We are asking you. And they said, well, we can't, because you are children. You haven't lived in the world. You don't understand our problems. We are here to work. We are migrants. We have no vested interest in what's going on in Johannesburg. We just want to, you know. So there was lots of tensions between the migrants and the locals. And, it was very interesting for me. And at the same time, these kinds of splits were also happening in white society, you know. It was really at Wits that I got my political education, and You know, I joined the incipient trade union movement. I translated the Workers' Magazine into Zulu. I got arrested by the security police on a particular mission that we had to go up to then Pietersburg, now Polokwane, into Seshego Township to get their payslips. Because the government had at the time they had this decentralization policy, and they were allowing international companies to pay below poverty datum line wages. Mm. So we would take these pay slips and send them to the parliament in England and to France, and this would be raised in parliament. Right. So the security police were very aware of this, and they were trying to stop it, and they stopped us. We were arrested, and they. So you know, I had that journey as a activist student, but my cultural journey continued because I had made very good friendships and very good networks in the migrant labor community around Johannesburg. To be honest, you know, my mom was very worried about me. And in my matric year, she said, "The Zulus have stolen you away from me. You never go. You have no real white friends anymore. You're out in the hostels every weekend. You're dancing at night. You're taking your bicycle, driving to Hillbrow, going to do your rehearsals on Tuesday night and Thursday night. And you just sit in your room and you play the music, and then you're out in the streets again, you know." And
she must have been fearful.
Yeah, I was arrested when I was 15 inside the hostels. Right. And they, you know, they reported to her, the police arrested me and took me home and said, "You know, your son is in a hostel," which is crazy. "We carry guns to go in there, and he's in the middle of them dancing in there." You know, it's,
right,
tribes. These are, you
but
know.
But it was about apartheid enforcement. It was about curfews. And blacks and whites.
Absolutely.
You know, it was nothing beyond.
Listen, I remember in Kensington when I arrived from Zimbabwe with my mom when I was about 8. Mm. At 9 o'clock, there was a siren that went off in Kensington. It was like
I actually had no idea.
Yes, they had a siren, and if any black person was found after the siren, they would be arrested walking in the streets.
I don't remember that.
It's called white by night.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, you know, there were all of these crazy things that were happening. And, you know,
did I read somewhere that you spent some time in Israel as a kid?
My mom divorced my father in England when I was 6 months old. And I went back to Zimbabwe, where she was born.
She was from Zimbabwe, right.
Yeah, on a farm. And then I spent – it was a transition period of about 6 months. But I don't – you know, I've got pictures of me at, like, you know, 1 year old running on the beaches.
But your Jewish identity was never a strong identity for you?
No, it was never a strong identity for me.
Did it become so later on in your life?
Not really. You know, I refused to have a bar mitzvah. I went when I was 12. I went to cheder.
That's quite gutsy, hey?
And my mom married out the faith twice.
What about the presents?
No. It wasn't about that at all. No, I had quite a strong reaction to my cheder teacher. She was an Auschwitz survivor.
Yeah, and they weren't the best educators. Unfortunately, the damage that came with them.
Yeah, so, you know, we were told, there were 6 of us in the class, and, you know, we were always told that, you know, we had to carry the burden of history and all that stuff. And, you know, Hitler's coming again, and you're going to, you know, I said, you know, Ma, I don't really want this.
Yeah.
I don't want to carry that. That's not for me. You know, I'm not. So I, but, you know, my cousins were all, you know, they were all very, very Jewish, and my one cousin was a Zionist, and my sister, Diane, my half sister, actually settled in Israel in Moedin. And unfortunately, she died of cancer at the age of 38. It was a really sad affair for my mom and me. So I we used to debate and argue, and, you know, and I said, "This is my country.
So your strongest identity was as a South African and part of the Zulu culture, rather than a religion that didn't speak to you.
Yeah. Also, you know, I never learned Hebrew, and the fact that the you know, It's very strange because my sister used to tell me, I don't understand you. You know, you learned Zulu and you got anything. Why can't you learn Hebrew? And I said, well, because it's not the spoken language in this country. She says, because the Hebrew will unlock all sorts of things for you. And I said, but, you know, it doesn't interest me. I don't have any interest in it. But I hear the sound of the country that I live in. I hear the music. I hear the languages.
Well, you hear it through your music. You know, we can hear, if there's one thing that comes across, well, not one thing, it's multiple things that come across in your music, but you can actually hear the sound of Africa. And I don't know if it's only because we grew up with a soundtrack of your music in our youth, but your music has become synonymous with the sound of Africa.
Well, what happened for me is I played traditional Maskanda music for 7 years with Sipho Mxinu from 1969 till around about 1975, 76. And then I'd heard echoes of, you know, I loved Celtic folk music. I love Irish and Scottish and, you know, English folk music. And I started to hear melodies that were very similar and rhythms. And so I thought, you know what, maybe there's a conversation that could take place between these two musics. And so we started to get a crossover.
Yeah.
And that's how Juluka started. It started by this experiment with crossover music. And in 1976, I had my first hit called Was a Friday, which was a folk music, hammer claw picking guitar style with kind of country and western chords and melody, but totally in Zulu, which had never been done before. It was like a total experiment, and it was a smash hit for me. And I was an honors student on my way to become a social anthropologist and teach at WITS for 3 years and 1 year in Durban, at the university there. And you know, Sipho was a gardener, and I was teaching, and we put out these albums, so we didn't get any airplay, and our first album was a flop. And the second album, we had a huge hit with African Sky Blue and Impi. And then we did a Zulu album called Ubuhle Bemvelo, which a lot of people don't know. And then on the fourth album, I was in my fourth year of teaching, Scatlings, the album Scatlings. The song Scatlings got onto the 50 in England.
Yeah, that was in the UK top.
Yeah, and it was a fork in the road for me. You know, either you're going to be a musician or an anthropologist.
It was always fascinating to me that that you had success overseas.
It was a total, absolute.
We felt kind of possessive, by the way. No, we weren't always comfortable with that because you really did belong to us.
That's right.
Yeah, but there was obviously a sense of pride that.
You must understand something about me and what my journey has been. My journey has been about the South African experience. My journey has been writing about that and thinking about it and trying to understand where I fit in. And people have enjoyed my grappling with those issues. They've enjoyed that because they've grappled with it. Whether you are black or you're white, you've grappled with where do I fit in here? And how can I make it better?
Well, in fact, we were talking about this the other day because it was Heritage Day.
Yes.
And I was wondering if we have a collective South African experience and a collective heritage, and I don't mean a braai, but even though that might well be part of it, but it's a very difficult thread to find.
I would like to tell you that every single African culture has leaked into its neighbors. You have to understand that. When I watch Venda dancing and the Shanga and the Mchongolo, I know that the Mchongolo has influenced Ishameni dancing in Zulu.
Right.
Okay. There's certain steps which the Zulu stole from the Shanga. There's been the strangest thing is that with first English segregation, which was a low-grade apartheid, to apartheid itself, the so-called, you know, from 1910 union.
Right. There's been
a lot of mixing. There's been a lot of, you know, adopting words.
And, well, I see it as a tapestry. I see it as an interweaving of fabrics.
So what apartheid did is it tried to exaggerate the differences. and the progressive forces in South Africa emphasized the similarities. It was that right. it was that issue. And so when I see because I'm a dancer and because I've been involved also in a lot of research into dance and movement and the human body and how it's been shaped by traditional cultures, I see Mchongolo and I see, you know, Venda and I see other styles of dancing, and I can see the leakage across the forms. And I can see certain Sotho words and Zulu words or Sotho and Nguni languages. Just different pronunciations of the base word, you know.
That's
so
interesting.
So mlilo, muriro, you know, in Zimbabwe. So then,
do you think that as a South African culture, collective culture,
yes,
we're moving in the right direction? I don't mean politically, because
I think that the
politically
base,
we're a mess.
No, no,
and that's not
sure.
That's not even the discussion.
Yeah, no. I think that the cultural base is here, and that. In traditional religions, in the traditional economies, the idea of ancestors and how ancestors operate, it's exactly the same across every culture.
Yeah,
we've got 11 official languages. That's
absolutely
all the same. It's
it's
just got a different inflection here and a different inflection there. So I would emphasize the similarities. I mean, you can talk about differences, because everybody wants to, you know, feel different and feel special and feel, you know, oh no, we do it this way or whatever. But what you might call the deep matrix of language and the deep matrix of traditional cultural expression resonates across all of the South African black cultures.
The Southern African cultures.
Yes. You know, it's you know, if you speak Spanish, you understand Italian, you know, and French, you know, so all the Latin languages, although they'll tell you, I'm Spanish, I'm not French, I don't do what the French do. But basically, these are people who have been shaped by wars and you know, Roman colonialism.
Right, and borders are a fiction anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, they just.
So one has to look at that and all I was trying to do is to work out, especially when I was like 16, I wanted to be a Zulu, you know what I mean? It was a very, very simple notion in my head that I could actually garner all of these cultural ideas and values and worldview and enjoy it and be part of it, you know. I was involved in so many crazy things when I was young, you know.
What was the soundtrack of your youth?
Was it
everything?
It was, yeah, I was very eclectic. I liked Simon and Garfunkel. I didn't like rock music. Rock for me was, I was a folky because it was acoustic music, which
right.
was, you know, so Pete Seeger, Bob Dylan, Simon and Garfunkel.
It's interesting you said about Simon and Garfunkel, because when I was thinking about this earlier,
yes.
to me, you are the South African Simon and Garfunkel.
Okay.
So it's interesting that was an influence.
Yes.
It was
Jethro Tull was huge for me. Jethro Tull was because Jethro Tull was Celtic folk music mixed with all sorts of Western influences, you know, from folk music to rock to jazz to, you know, and the incredible experimentation with rhythms and that. It's very, very, you know, appealing to me. And I was liberally influenced by the singing style and everything. You know, when you listen to Impi and you listen to Sky Blue, you know, it was those kinds of international bands. And of course, here, many, 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 many musicians that you would never know, because,
right.
you know, they were traditional Zulu musicians. A very famous one called Puz Shugela, the sugar drinker. He was the main spearhead. He was the most famous Zulu street guitarist who recorded. So you could buy his records.
Right.
But he was a guy who hung out in the hostels. You know, he'd go there and play with anybody in the street. You know, it was just, you know, he made records and that was it. But he wanted to still be part of it.
It's incredible, because you describe that time as with a certain a time of innocence in some
way. It was very innocent.
Which is incredible.
That's very perceptive, because I gave myself to my universe. I trusted the universe that I was in.
And it gave back that trust.
And it gave back the trust.
We are running out of time, but tell me, you've got a final show coming up.
Yes, it's at the Dome on the 11th of November. It is my final public show to my public in Johannesburg, it's basically the same.
Is it very
show.
Emotional for you? It's a very hard.
It's a very bittersweet thing for me. You know, my health condition is triggered this right. this tour. I've just come out my second chemo in February, and I just said to my management, I'd like to wrap up this while I have the chance, because you never know what might unfold in the future. Right. So it's bittersweet, and I stand on stage and I think, you know, this is my final, and
but you must be very proud of what you've
I'm
achieved.
Very proud, and I'm very I feel blessed, and I feel
do you feel regret in any way?
I have no regrets. I've done crazy things, and life is a learning curve. And one has to, accept that nobody is all seeing and all, all omniscient.
Yeah, well, if any of us were perfect, that would be wonderful.
Yeah,
wouldn't it?
So we all have our warts, and from my point, I never did anything harmful intentionally. I tried my best. I had my arguments and my fights, and even with my compatriots who are fighting activists. In the end, I said, listen, I'm not a trade unionist.
Right.
I can't bear to see what.
But you come from a place of authenticity,
and
that's really what it's about. And that's to me what defines your music, and it defines who you are in terms of your career, because it's just authentic, real. You've captured the essence of what South Africa is.
And, thank you.
I wish you luck, and as we say in Hebrew, Tzeitchem leshalom, go in peace.
Thank you.
And certainly we will do what we can to make sure that we're at that concert and continue to support your music.
Thanks very much.
This is Howard Feldman. I've been chatting with Johnny Clegg.